Right, we're on. We're back here with Townhouse Episode 2. My name's Matt Oliver and I'm here with...
Stephen Dalton. I'm pretty annoyed. This shambles has taken an age to start.
But luckily we've got two microphones that are working now, although we are recording in a ridiculous manner.
Come on, let's go! Boom!
So, we're just coming back to talk about the second episode of Townhouse, which was filmed, it was called Battle Estate.
I'm glad and you found your microphone after half an hour.
Missing in between the thousands of bottles of ale we have in this little twitching den.
No. Don't call it a twitching den. People can't see it. They'll get the wrong idea.
They will be able to see it.
This is a sports bar. It has a draft ale pump, and like you say, lots of bottles of beer. We've got bar stools, for Christ's sake.
There is zero... sports paraphernalia in here.
There's a sportsman here.
You don't look like a sportsman to me.
Thank you. You thought it was me.
As you've probably gathered, we are not two academically qualified historians. We are basically two history fans.
It's about our second episode. War, what is it good for? Street names. That's what it's good for. That sounds dull, but we're going to make it interesting for you.
Street names, yeah. Yeah, so... we basically went to the... and actually, we should quickly point out that this was actually the first one we filmed.
Yes, and it was the first one we filmed. You didn't know what we were doing, because basically, this accompanies the video that we made about the Battle Estate. Yeah. And there are some time hops in it. And poor Matt had no idea what was going on when I dragged him along. And we had to film in the middle of a street fair. Three scenes to cut into something he had no idea about yet.
Which... I'm not sure has much relevance to the actual topic of the episode, but it was fun.
It just stops it being boring to watch. Mm. This podcast is not going to make any sense unless you go and watch it. So you need to go to YouTube and go to Townhouse TV. It is Townhouse TV. And look at the Battle Estate episode. And that will make all of this conversation make much more sense.
Do you want to give the listeners a quick overview?
Well, we began in the middle of a street in North London that was built... in the middle of the 19th century, middle of the 1800s. And this was when not just London, but lots of housing was built in several cities, and cities really exploded. And what we are trying to point out is the origin of the naming of streets. Mm. And we took this little area, which is named after battles in the Crimea and generals of the Crimea, to try and demonstrate that. But wherever you live, not just in this country, as I will tell you in a minute, wherever you live, this policy of naming in the middle of the 19th century stretches all over the world. And the reason they did it then and not now is because they were much more into their heroes in those days. But also, there was such an explosion of street building that they needed lots of names pretty quickly. So
we needed lots of wars.
Well, they just thought that you know, your streets where you live, if the city is that old, we'll have lots of streets named after either local heroes, regional heroes, or national ones and national events. So they're often named after famous battles or famous individuals who took part in those battles, or local issues named after people who were around there at that time. So it doesn't just apply here; it applies to every city in Britain, but it also applies to other countries. And if you think of the reach of the British Empire in the middle of the 1800s, then this applies to a host of other places.
Yeah, like Baker Street.
Yeah, but that's much more traditional. I mean, I'm thinking of
trades and stuff as well. Anything,
but that goes. The trades go back.
So
way
they basically
further.
they ran out of names.
Well, they needed a whole bunch of names
so
quickly.
More names, and then that's where they went for sort of generals' names and.
Yeah, because all of these buildings were stretching outwards from a city that had history where bakers would be on a street. And you're stretching these new buildings into fields that previously had nothing. Once you name it after the landowner or a couple of landowners who were there, you need a whole bunch more than two streets. Yeah. So what do we name them after? Things with no connection, famous people and individuals and events. So what I really like about this is that you can see the history of not just Britain and your city, but the countries that you live in through the street names from this period. It's kind of gone out of fashion now. And people tend to name streets and, you know, estates after a series of flowers
which is
much more naff, in my opinion.
I was actually looking at some names just before we did the podcast, and if you think Westminster, which apparently is Edward the Confessor, named Minster in the West, is Westminster.
I'm not sure I would have figured that.
Yeah, and there's also Stew Lane, which was you would have been recognised. It's advertised for not for casseroles, but brothels. And I'm just wondering.
Stew is an old-fashioned Tudor name, pre-Tudor name. A stew is a name for a brothel.
Ah.
Yeah, there were lots of stews. You often see reports in about cracking down on the stews that were predominantly south of the river, in London. Yeah, that happens a lot.
Well, that's.
Can I tell you how prevalent this fashion for naming things after battles and people are?
Please do.
Well, the street that we start on in the video is
he's forgotten.
No, Alma was the second. We started on Inkerman, didn't we?
Inkerman, yeah.
Yeah, Alma's the second street that we walk down, where I throw the tea over my shoulder, walking towards the camera in classic documentary style. Well, Alma Street, I did a quick look for this, and it was only a quick look, so I'm sure that this applies elsewhere. There's an Alma Street in Sheffield that has an Alma pub on it, although the pub is now been renamed the Fat Cat. There's an Alma Street in Luton, and right like ours in Kentish Town, it's next to Inkerman Street and Cardigan Street. There's even a Raglan house on it, and there's a Raglan Street next to ours. There's one in Coventry, there's one in Smethwick in the West Midlands, and one in Aylesbury, where you are currently residing. There's one in Colchester, Liverpool, Manchester, in Eccles, Leeds, Stoke-on-Trent. And that's just for looking around with Alma Street.
Yes.
You'll find a ton more if you look for Crescent, Close, Passage, etc.
So they're regurgitating all these names because there simply isn't enough to go around.
It just shows you the fashion and the prevalence for doing this. And that's just one battle that took part, that occurred in one war. When you start looking at other things, you see this repeated all over the country. There's even an Alma Street in the United States in San Francisco. It runs right past Stanford University. So if anyone is there, goes right past there. It's in Paris too.
If you're there,
there's
send
a
us
Hotel
a
Alma in Paris. There's a Place de Alma. There's even a metro stop in Paris called Alma. In Australia, there's streets in Fremantle, in Tasmania, in Paddington, in the Paddington district of Sydney. There are streets there called Alma. There's one in Melbourne. And in fact, a friend of mine, Jeff Wilkie, was telling me in Melbourne there's an Alma Road and Inkerman Street, all in the district of Balaclava.
So, even though we've filmed this and we've already made this episode, Alma's the place.
Alma is a street, but Alma is also a place in the Crimean
That's what
War.
I mean,
it's a famous
War.
Battle the British took part in. If you've watched the video, we make that clear.
The battle is in Alma.
The battle is next to a village called Alma, which is of little significance, I think. I hope people in the Crimea don't object to that.
They may do.
I'm hoping they don't listen.
I mean, obviously, you spoke about the actual reasons of the Crimea, but you should probably give us a quick blast of why that took place. Russians.
It's the Russians trying to extend their influence south to take over what everybody thought would be an imminently collapsing Turkey, because that would give them a gateway to the Mediterranean to get their Black Sea fleet out and challenge the preeminence of France and Britain.
And
in
Britain's
the Mediterranean.
Indian territory.
There was that threat if you went in the other direction, yeah. And so Britain and France desperately want to prop Turkey up. And so, I mean, there are excuses, like there are, well, ostensibly this is what it's about. It's Russia attempting to squeeze a bit of Turkey out of the way, and Britain and France jumping to Turkey's aid against them. And they end up fighting in the Crimean Peninsula at the top of the Black Sea.
Yeah, and it's also Russia making a bit of a statement religiously as well.
Well, the excuse is they're defending Christian minorities.
The holiest sites.
Yeah, they're defending Christian minorities from Turkish oppression. That's the excuse. But that's much less exciting than international conflicts for power.
It's funny, isn't it? The British don't like it, the imperialism. And if somebody else is doing it.
Yeah, we love it, as long as we're doing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you know NASA also have an Alma?
I did know that.
Oh, really?
No, I didn't know that. Of course I didn't know that.
It has nothing to do with the Battle of Alma, though. I am sorry to disappoint you.
So the Crimean War, going back to that, I mean, what sort of warfare are we talking here? Because this is apparently the the sort of most modern, the first modern war of its kind, yeah, in the fact that you've got photographers, you've got reporters.
It's not quite modern warfare in terms of World War One, but we're getting there. But it's certainly a modern war in terms of reporting. Mm. And this is really what makes the difference to a whole bunch of stuff that we'll talk about in a moment. You had reporters who followed battles around and followed the army around. And because of telegraph and cable, you were able to get back the pictures. Well, not maybe not pictures, they would take longer. But you were able to get back reports almost within a day of a battle that had just taken place. And I do not exaggerate when I say that people actually almost virtually went on holiday to go and watch the battles.
No way.
I'm not kidding you. They literally, women and wealthy men, would take a caravan and a picnic out and sit on top of a ridge next to the battle and watch the charges and the battle unfold between them, because they were still fairly obvious sort of set piece battles, yeah, like Napoleonic style.
It wasn't like skirmishes but, and just chaos. Yeah,
they were literally tourist events that people went to watch. I know that sounds amazing.
Was there anyone selling? Was there any middlemen selling tickets, seats, popcorn?
I'm not sure you can sell tickets to a hill, but people did. Absurd as it sounds,
crazy, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's mad. Also, in terms of equipment and weaponry, and international alliances and stuff, this is quite a unique war, isn't it?
I don't
know.
Nations
getting together, would you say?
I don't think it is. No, there'd been a grand coalition against Napoleon. That was 1815. This is 1854. It's not too different to that.
It's a standard warfare.
In Napoleonic times, if people are familiar with that, then we're talking there. Have you seen any of the Sean Bean Sharps rifle stuff? For
love of the books, I haven't seen much of
that.
Actually,
then it's that. We've got sort of cavalry, infantry, bayonet, drills, discipline, and cannon. Mm. Perhaps some mortar in early fashion, but not too much more than that. So standard sort of items that you might move around a risk board if you're playing that game. No?
Real risk.
But risk for real, yeah, indeed.
I mean, forgive
people
my
people do call it the first modern war, though.
Yeah, but you've still got sword fighting here. And
You do. When the cavalry charges go, they are with drawn sword.
Yeah.
Yeah, to slash people with, for sure. Britain was not in a position really to fight this war. We were living on our Napoleonic glories.
What do you mean in terms of we didn't have the money to finance it, or we just weren't strong enough to beat the Russians?
We had beaten Napoleon, who had beaten everybody else, and we were top dog in 1815, and we took some colonies and we ruled the world and. We're at the height of empire, and we imagine we're God's gift, and we hadn't been beaten in combat since then, but we'd been fighting, you know, colonial enemies with sticks, and we had not fought a modern European army like Russia was to present to us since Napoleon, and we hadn't done very much to prepare for it either. The soldiers who enlisted in the army were either driven into it by poverty, or a third of them were calculated to be of criminal nature, because you could join the army or go to jail for some of your offences. Drunkenness was considered rife. And there was one example of a trooper in the 7th Hussars who was flogged to death for drunkenness in 1846, which is only 8 years before the battle. And our expenditure is only one quarter of what it was prior to the Battle of Waterloo. So we're living on glories. These are not the best of men you could have as soldiers. We're not investing in it.
But we still won.
Well,
didn't we?
No, not really. Jury's out. I say no.
You say
call,
no.
Call it an honourable draw.
The thing is, that, I mean, Russia was defeated, though, wasn't it? And it was told that it had to decommission any of its naval bases.
Yeah, but I think what had happened. I mean, you can call it a victory because Russia was prevented from doing what it wanted. So in that sense, objective was achieved. But we had suffered, and victory was not easy. No. It was, and in that sense, people call it a modern war. It was a hard slog for sort of yards of territory, and it was a long, drawn-out affair. of attrition. And that has similar connotations with the American Civil War that follows it, yeah, and World War One.
And reports of over 200,000 deaths, I believe, in the Crimean War.
I swore I would be prepared for this, you would not catch me out. I swore.
I think I've won that, but that's...
You've totaled up everybody,
haven't you?
That
is what my research tells me.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds about right. I think, yeah, that sounds close to... I might put a little bit less, but I don't know the Turkish casualties. French and British were not nearly that much. The Russians lost a huge amount more than we did, maybe three times as much.
That's crazy. Well, we should, going from there, we should probably talk about some of the heroes from the war. You just touched on the charge of the Light Brigade, so you should probably talk
that's
about...
That's in the second battle in Balaclava. I think maybe we should address them in order.
Oh, okay, okay.
So
let's go.
Alma is the first battle, although it's the second Street of Mon. Balaclava, the second battle. There is no Street of Balaclava in our video, but it's often linked to them. And then the third one was Inkerman.
So what was the deal with Alma?
Well, I think that... I'm not sure how to talk about this. I could talk about the generals now or the battles. Which way do you want it?
Well, who was the general at Alma, or was it
of the forces, a chap called Lord Raglan, and I think I point out that he's one of the streets next door to ours, and he's the commander of the army. He had actually served under Wellington. He was one of Wellington's most senior commanders. He was his personal military secretary, so you couldn't get a greater connection. However, he had only taken over in 1852, because Wellington himself had remained commander-in-chief until 1852, when he died at the grand old age of 83. So this guy had served under Wellington all his life, Raglan. Yep. Take over, great. He was renowned for being a hero and being brave. He lost an arm himself at Waterloo. So he
How
rides
did he
his
lose
horse.
It? Was it shot off or hacked off?
No, it was. He got it injured. I think it was shot and got injured. He had it amputated and requested no anaesthetic for the process. Because he asked for it to be given to him when it was hacked off, so that he could remove his wedding ring, that his wife had given him. Yeah, so this guy was, he had a lot of respect.
And was probably very drunk.
Oh, you would imagine so. But he was ancient. And they all were. I think he's in his 70s, Raglan.
Raglan's in his 70s?
Yeah,
blimey.
Well, he'd served under Wellington in 1815, and this is 1854.
And is it? I'm sure...
But 13 of the British Army's generals were over the age of 70. 37 of them were over the age of 60. So this is an army in no shape to fight a modern European enemy.
Even Lord Cardigan was 57.
Oh, considerably young by comparable amounts.
That seems ridiculously old for...
Yeah, but when you've got 37 people over 60, 13 of them over 13, and a one-armed commander...
This is not Dad's army. This is Granddad's army.
Yeah, you're right. And we thought we were going to flog them like every war, like World War One. We thought it'll all be done by Christmas and we'll be home victorious.
Yeah,
but it didn't go that way.
No. So you've spoken about Raglan, the one-armed Raglan.
You have to respect him, though.
You do have to respect him. Yeah. The other one is
Just
thinking of Evil Dead, Ash out of Evil Dead with one arm, chainsaw. But Lord Cardigan, 7th Earl of Cardigan, I believe. 57 years old. Apparently a perpetual duelist, as in very argumentative. Loved a scrap. And apparently a habitual seducer of women as well. I'd imagine he was quite a formidable force to be reckoned with.
He was, yeah. And he's in command of the Light Brigade, who make the charge, isn't he?
Does he survive that charge?
He does, yes. But he gets considerable amount of blame and ends up home in disgrace before the war has ended.
When you say he led the charge of the Light Brigade, presumably he wasn't at the front of the charge, was he?
Yes, he was.
How the hell did he survive that?
It was the done thing. Another part of the British Army's problem is they put more stock in commanding officers having bravery and daring do than in skillful judgment. And he's an example of that. Mm. But he was expected to lead at the front. That was what was done. But he did not get on with the man who issued the command to his division to charge. He said, are you sure? Will you check the order? And the reply was, Lord Raglan wills it. And so you have this sort of typical stoic British officer, I must do my duty, even though I know I'm going to my death type thing. It's a genuine element to the officer class at this time.
Right, chaps, get on. Off we go.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was with such excitement, but yes, that sort of thing.
Wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, that sort of attitude definitely.
Do you know what I think it was? I think it was because they were so old. They thought, well, we've had a good innings. I mean, if we go down now, that's fine at 70 or 60, isn't it? So therefore, we'll lead this charge.
Well, Carnegie, as you say, wasn't that old.
57 is for back then, surely.
Yeah, but if we look at the people around him.
But what else is interesting is a man of such bravery actually ends up giving a name to one of the wettest items ever.
Well, the cardigan. I see what
exactly.
You're saying. Yeah, but the thing about the cardigan is that people wore it a bit like they wear T-shirts today to support our troops or Help for Heroes or stuff like that.
Oh, right, okay.
You know, it was because it was cold out there, you see. And the British Army, this is another problem, that they were not equipped for winter war and they didn't have winter clothing. So people like Cardigan took to wearing a woolly vest, you know,
and under just his tunic. Yeah, it was the item already existed, but he actually named it through just...
By wearing it. I mean, the balaclava as well, the bank robber's mask, that comes from soldiers who fought at the Battle of Balaclava wearing this thing.
But wasn't that sent out to them from wives and stuff at home?
You're right, yes, yeah. You have done your research. It was. A lot of them were sent out and knitted because they became... not fashion, but the necessity in that respect. And there is actually, I think, in Stirling Council Museum or something like that, I did find this somewhere, there is a letter from the mother of a soldier. It's from Granny Bryce to Captain John Murray, who is stationed at the siege of Sevastopol in 1855. I'll tell you about that in a minute. She sent a balaclava to her son as soldiers were so ill-equipped in the cold. And I think she refers to it, you know, saying, oh, you know, I think she sends him two, one for him and one for a friend, whoever he chooses, whatever. It's new, it's the latest fashion. Sometimes it's referred to as a mask or a visor. But I think this letter might refer to it as a balaclava.
Right.
And I think there's the odd photo slinging around the internet of
and
these very
did they
early
know
things.
It would be the bank robber's choice?
They didn't know. But then, you know, I'm pretty sure Toyota didn't think their flatback van would become the choice of warmongering rebels across the equatorial countries of the world.
That is true.
The advertising from that is stunning, isn't it?
It's insane.
Toyota flatback rebels. Do you know there was a war? I think it's...
funded all the wars.
There was a war called the Toyota War.
No.
Where an army, I think from Chad or something like this, you can Google it on the internet, an army was sent to their neighbour to in like something like 40 flatbacks with mounted machine guns and troops hanging off the side of them, and they won.
Oh my God.
Sent this flying squad of flatback Toyotas across the border in Sahara in Africa.
So the I'm
pretty sure it's called the Toyota War.
The flatback Toyota is the machine of war.
If you're a cheap dictator, yes.
Wow.
Yeah. It's got nothing to do with the Crimea, I'm sorry.
It hasn't. I'll go back to the Crimea and I'll go back to the... just because we were touching on the balaclavas and Raglan. I didn't actually realise this, and maybe you didn't, but... The Raglan is an overcoat as well. Did you know that? It's just one arm.
Can I say yes if you don't ask me any more?
You don't know, do you? The raglan is an actual jacket.
I swore you wouldn't catch me out.
The sleeves come right up to the chest there. Both sleeves come up like that. But obviously, with him, you probably only need one sleeve, like a trunk.
No, you would conspicuously pin the other one to the front of your jacket, so people knew.
Which got me thinking about all the other leaders that have inspired various apparel.
Don't you dare.
Let me just quickly say, obviously, Duke of Wellington. Are you going to say no?
No, I wasn't going to say no. It was just the obvious one I wanted you not to start with.
But you started with it initially. And then, so you've got the Duke of Wellington, the wellies. You've got Raglan, the Raglan overcoat. You've got the balaclava, the woolly bank robber's mask. You've got, what's the other one we've already said? The cardigan. Then you can go to jodhpurs, which are horse riding, which actually originate from the Indian trouser called the churidar, which is a tight around the calf and baggy at the hips and still worn
by the famous jodhpur polo team.
Then you go
jodhpur,
from that.
India.
I'm going back quite a few years here. Then you go back to
the grey coat worn by Dorian Gray.
No. Slightly digressing. Richard II, who invented the handkerchief. Did you know that?
Who?
Richard II actually invented the handkerchief.
I don't believe you.
That's 100% true. And I can even read you a message from his tailor. It says,
how have you crowbarred this in?
Let me just quickly get it in. Small pieces made for giving to the Lord King to carry in his hand for wiping and cleaning his nose. And that was prior, obviously, that we used to use the handkerchief.
So he didn't call it the handkerchief?
No, he did. I don't know if he called it the handkerchief, actually, but I know that
because
he was
the first.
Because
they used to be called kerchiefs, didn't they?
Yeah, I don't know about that. I can't go from that. But also,
so that letter, you're meaning he's the first person to ever use a square piece of cloth for his nose or something. That's what you're putting it down to. At this point, you need to say, arguably.
Arguably, yes. Sorry. That is the motto of Tailhouse. Everything is arguably.
If we're not sure.
Because not all historians are sure.
No one's going to bother to argue against us.
Let me just quickly wrap this piece up. Did you like that? Wrap it up, clothing-wise. So we've gone from the balaclava to Richard II's handkerchief to the jodhpurs, and we should probably finish off at the shell suit, which is a premium tracksuit or an upgrade for a tracksuit. Oh, no,
I did what is
make,
this? What
I did make one other note. Hang on. The jeans, denim.
I know that.
Did
I've
you
been
know?
There.
Did
I've
you
been
know?
There.
That they're developed in the French town of Nîmes, as in Denim.
Because Denim means from Nîmes.
Yeah,
Nîmes is an old Roman town.
I just thought that was interesting. I just thought it was worth throwing that in because it's so much of the Crimean War and the generals and clothing. There's a lot of clothing, a lot of apparel related issues in the Crimean War.
There is.
Is that the best historical statement you've ever heard?
I didn't expect to be talking about the French town of Nîmes or Richard II's handkerchief.
No, neither did I.
But there we go.
But it's in there. So we'll go back to the Crimean War, or have we pretty much
Well, I can tell you about the battles, since we talk about them on the streets very briefly. I don't want to dull everyone's attention.
Have you got any more information about any clothing?
No, is that my cut-off?
No. Go on. Tell us about the battles.
Well, Alma is the first engagement.
Yeah.
And the French and the British together march and dislodge the Russians from a hill. In under 3 hours, it's considered to be pretty good. And everyone thinks, hurrah, onwards to Sevastopol, which is the port capital of the Crimea. And we should be there in no trouble. We should be winning. And that's the expectation, because Alma is quite a victory. That's the first battle that we're involved in. However, it doesn't go so well for there, because the second battle is Balaclava, where we are positioned at the end of two valleys, and the Russian army, considerably larger, is stationed at the other end. And they originally attack some Turkish forces on the ridge in between these two valleys.
Okay.
So the other end of the valley, you've got proper solid emplacements, and it looks like suicide to make this, sort of charge down the valley in open face of the Russian cannon to go at them at point blank range. And so he asks for the order to be checked. And of course, this is a delay. People get annoyed. Yes, charge. And the guy just says, well, of course, there is your enemy, sir. You're commanded to charge. And so he does. So it's a miscommunication.
Mm.
But when you get something on this scale, someone's head has to roll. So they charged down the valley, and they, you know, surprisingly, about more than half of them return. And the Russians are stunned.
The Russians are thinking, what is going on?
Well, one of the Russian commanders is actually reported as saying he sees the English Light Brigade, who are charging towards this full battery of Russians with an army behind it, down an open valley, you know, sitting ducks. He sees them charging towards it. And a lot of the Russians think they're mad, and there's a kind of pause in fire to begin with. Really? Shall we fire at them? Yeah. And one Russian commander sort of observes it and says, it's marvellous, but it's not war. And they promptly open fire. About a third of them, maybe 40% of them are killed. They succeed in taking the Russian cannon and killing a few people. But there's an enormous army there. So there's this awful...
Why did he say it's not war? I don't understand.
Because it's suicide. This charge is suicide.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so he says, it's magnificent, yeah, but it's not war, which I think is a wonderful description of this charge coming towards you. That looks, you know, truly heroic and at the same time utterly hopeless.
So basically, he just wanted to take a bit of time to soak up that.
Soak up the glory that was approaching him, knowing that they were all going to be killed. Yeah, that's a wonderful phrase, though, isn't it?
It is amazing, actually.
So they do actually take over the guns, you know, they do, you know, surprise the Russian army there, but then there are so few of them that they have to turn around and charge back again to the other end of the valley, back to their own troops. And be fired on again. And when they get back there, Cardigan is absolutely lambasted. You know, what the hell are you doing charging the other end of the valley into suicide? And he said, I will not take the blame. That's what I was ordered to do. And the man who delivered the instruction was actually killed by a shrapnel explosion. So he can't be questioned and nothing can be proved. Cardigan ends up suffering for it, really. Although he lives, you know, he lives off the story forever. He's a sort of leading a heroic charge. Raglan suffers from it too. He ends up being replaced. It's a disaster for the British. But we like.
But it's memorable, and it meant that we could see the swingboard in the episode with the charge of the Light Brigade.
Indeed.
On it. It's basically now somebody's house.
Don't forget Tennyson's poem.
I don't understand this Tennyson's poem. I mean,
Into the Valley of Death rode the 600. Well, if you don't understand, if you know what I'm talking about,
I don't know the poem.
Alfred Lord Tennyson was poet laureate. He wrote a famous poem about the charge of the Light Brigade, where the cadence of him speaking sounds like the gallop of horse in a charge. It's really good. It's got that beat to it. But there is a very old wax recording of him that's quite fuzzy that you can see on YouTube. If you type in Lord Tennyson, Charge the Light Brigade, you can hear a very old wax recording of himself reading the poem. 1890 is the recording. It's an Edison wax cylinder.
Wow.
And he's 80 years old. I think he dies a couple of years after that. So
it's
one of the earliest recordings. No. Just, you know, onwards, onwards, half a league onwards, into the Valley of Death rode the 600. It's got that sort of cadence of... Yeah. Of galloping horses. Mm. And there's no footage of this, obviously, because it's too early for film, but the earliest footage of something similar to this is a movie they made about this in 1938, starring Errol Flynn.
I think I saw snippets of it, actually.
You will have done, because you're a heavy metal fan.
Yeah, I've
seen. Tell me where you've seen it, then.
Sky Channel.
No. You're a heavy metal fan.
Oh,
there's the clue.
You're not talking about Maiden.
Yes.
Oh. You know always try and get a metal reference in there, don't you?
You know the Iron Maiden video to The Trooper?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, The Trooper is a song about a soldier in the Crimean War. That's what it's about.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And if you listen to the lyrics, it's about a soldier who dies in the Crimean War in battle. And so in the video, they use film footage from Errol Flynn's 1938 film about the Charge of the Light Brigade. Fabulous scenes in black and white. And you know the video now. You're thinking about it, yeah?
Yeah.
But listeners can Google it and then come back and listen to us if they want to. But it's a really controversial film because 25 horses were killed in the making of the movie.
Oh, that's not good.
If you watch it, the horses fall like under sort of faux cannon fire in the Maiden video. And the way they did it is they got them to charge down across the screen and they tripwired the horses.
That is insane.
Yeah, so horses broke their leg, broke their knees, broke their necks. They tripwired them. They fall in this quite shocking fashion. And Iron Maiden were criticised for using the footage. But they pointed out, well, we didn't kill them. But it had an important effect. I mean, Errol Flynn actually attacked the director for doing this because he thought this was horrific. And he punched the director, a man called Michael Curtis. But the film resulted in a law to protect the safety of animals in films forevermore.
Because it would have happened again, wouldn't it?
Well, it was it caused such an outrage that Congress made a law to say, if you're going to use animals in films, you have to have some care for their welfare.
That's unbelievable, isn't it? Wow.
So, charge of the Light Brigade to animal welfare.
We're probably going to have to stop talking about the Crimean War because we're up to nearly 40 minutes now.
40?
Yeah.
All right.
37 minutes, and we haven't even gone on to the next two topics of the video, which is probably one of the most famous ladies. Certainly, some of her nicknames have been the Lady of the Lamp.
Yeah, she's always pictured with that sort of Aladdin's lamp.
That's it. It's not true, is it?
She never used an Aladdin's lamp. No, she used a lantern, I think.
Yeah, but she did use a lantern, but you know that she got that lantern from a Turkish market, don't you? She did.
Is that why they why they want to make it an Aladdin's lamp?
Possibly. She got it from a market in Constantinople.
Yeah.
On her way.
Okay.
To the Crimea, and I know that because I listened to a podcast very recently about it. But yeah, we should probably talk about...
You're not stealing anything here, are you?
No, not at all. Should probably talk about her a bit because you've
She has a bad reputation.
Sinner or saint? Why has she got a bad reputation?
Because people say... one of the criticisms about her is that she was fixated on things like smell and cleanliness, and she's criticised for denying infection and germs. But I think you have to place her in context. This is the early days of discovering germs and microbes, and a lot of it was not accepted for a good time after her. So she's not different to anybody else. But her methods were effective. And I think a lot of the judgment about her comes from, you know, judging her by modern standards, which is grossly unfair. But she did have a great effect. By the time the war ended, deaths... in a hospital in Scutari, which is a barracks in Istanbul where she was based for all the wounded soldiers. Deaths there were no worse than a good hospital back home in Manchester or something like that.
I read that there was an inch of excrement on the floor.
There were rats, there were drains, no toilets, drains that were blocked, no toilets, mouldy foods, basic stuff that we would recognise had to be changed.
So she went out there initially with a team of 38 nurses. That was a very unusual scenario, wasn't it? That hadn't been seen before. And how did she get on with the, obviously predominantly the mainly male doctors out there?
Not good, because the Army Medical Service were not particularly efficient. They weren't bothered about cleanliness and stuff like that. A lot of them drank, because you've seen some horrific stuff as well. Mm. But the army didn't like the intrusion. She was ignored for quite a while. She tried to get things done, and they tried to ignore her. And she really split army opinion and sort of civil service opinion back home. But she persisted and got what she wanted, got the improvements, and made a difference. But the army reacted very poorly to her. But back home, she was lauded.
But she was a bit of a celebrity back home, wasn't she?
Back home, really? Yeah, but not out there and not with the army. She found it very tough, and she was quite browbeaten by them. But she persisted, made the improvements, and set the foundation for modern nursing.
Yeah, yeah.
When she died? Do you know when she died?
I know she lived to be older than 70 because I heard a recording of her.
Yeah.
Which you could just barely make out.
She was one of the first people for this, for it to occur that people thought she was already dead, speak. Yeah. So you fast forward to 1900, 1902, and you get the Boer War, British in South Africa, and that's another. You know, that's the next big war we have after the 1850s, and that's a gap of almost 50 years, and. She's still alive, and people start talking about her, and then people point out, oh, she's still alive. And that is surprising. Because she goes out to the Crimea in her 30s, and 50 years later, she's still alive, and she becomes popular again. People had forgotten about her.
She's still going.
Yeah. Wow. So quite a bunch of stuff happens to her. She gets given the Order of the Merit, the first woman to be given the Order of Merit in 1907. Mm. She's given the freedom of the City of London in 1908. And she's offered a state funeral in 1910 when she dies. Right. 1910. She declined. Her family declined it, though. They didn't want her to be buried in Westminster, so yeah. She's not. She's buried in...
Her family never actually wanted her to get into nursing in the first place.
No, that's because nursing was a job for poor people.
And I think she was actually quite well off, wasn't she?
She came from a well-off family. But she grew up with a conscience and the idea that rich people should help poor people.
Yeah.
And nursing was a very poorly paid job with no status in society. Yeah. But she was determined to do it.
Born in Italy, in Florence, actually, hence her name.
Well, there was a resurgence in the name Florence when you got the Boer War in the 1900s.
Good name,
isn't it? Yeah,
it is. That's why we've got Florence and the Machine.
One of my friend's daughters is called Florence.
Yeah, it's a good name.
She's the first woman on an English banknote.
Really?
The old £10 note in 1975.
I want one.
Well, you can have a £5 note now, because the only other woman to have ever been on a banknote is Elizabeth Fry, the prison reformer, on our current £5 note.
Wow. I mean, you know, yeah. Fair enough, though. Would you say the kind of architect of the NHS was Florence Nightingale, basically? Because obviously she thought that this service should be provided for free. Anyone was entitled, even the poor were entitled to this.
She did think that, but I don't think you could make that claim about her. There are too many other things going on. There's the growth of the public health movement in the 1860s and 70s, which she does influence, but there's the growth of that. There's increasing government intervention. You've got political parties like starting the welfare state, and it all comes together with the Labour government after World War II. So I think there's a lot of stuff going on, and it would be far too generous to put that on her. But she certainly started modern nursing. Nurses all around the world take what's called the Nightingale Oath. It's a bit like the Hippocratic Oath for doctors. It's called the Nightingale Oath for nurses. Promise not to
poison people.
This is going
very Game of Thrones now. Men of the Night's Watch.
They do. They take the Nightingale Oath. There are the International Red Cross. Every 2 years, they award a Florence Nightingale Medal to outstanding nursing in the world. Wow. In 2015, they gave out 36 medals. If you go to the International Red Cross website, they'll tell you. To countries all over the world, 18 different countries. Not one of them to Britain. I didn't look at when the last one was. I thought it might depress me if I had to go back too far.
Good old Florence. We're probably closing up on the topic of Florence because we're now up to 40 minutes.
Can I point out that she ranked in 2002 as the 51st greatest Briton? Hmm. One place above Lawrence of Arabia, and one place below King Arthur, which strikes me as absurd, because King Arthur's not real. But she's been quite highly regarded consistently.
Very highly regarded, but also as a closing note, you think obviously Florence Nightingale being the champion of sanitation, yeah.
Definitely, I would definitely make that point.
But
sanitation, not medicine.
No, sanitation over medicine. Yeah. But that's fine. But there's a slight problem with that because a bracelet that she had and she wore for most of her life.
I've tried so hard. I don't know how you find stuff I don't know.
It was a bracelet made of human hair, and it was actually made of hair from her mother, her father, and her sister. Just imagine the diseases that was carrying. And that's actually in the Florence Nightingale Museum, which I've seen. Thank
that's
you.
A bit creepy.
It is weird, isn't it? Champion of sanitation wearing a
human
hairband.
She was single
hairband.
Her entire life as well. A bit odd.
Yeah.
Incidentally, in that list of greatest Britons, she is six places above Henry V.
Above Henry V? I know,
it's absurd.
How dare she?
I know. And
how King, dare she?
Below King Arthur there. These lists are of their time, so I don't think we should pay too much attention to him. No. But the fact she's still appearing on lists, I think, is
crazy. You didn't even mention her pie chart, which wasn't the pie chart, it was a polar chart.
She didn't invent it, but arguably a lot of her best work is done after she comes back from the Crimea. Because she's involved in public health reports, she's involved in setting up a nursing college, which is still incorporated into King's College Nursing in London today, and she does lots of statistical work to try to prove her stuff. She also spent some time improving soldiering casualties in India in the 1860s. Right. And that reduces in severity under her influence as well. So she's got influence all over the place.
She did present her information in a statistical way.
Yeah, pie charts, but sort of extended ones called polar charts.
But unfortunately, Edward Tufte doesn't mention her in his famous 1869 chart of the best statistical graphics ever drawn.
I think she certainly deserves to be.
She does deserve to be, but she's not mentioned. So we should probably move on from Florence to the other character and the other area in the video, which
why do you think it is that Florence Nightingale is what we most associate with the Crimean War?
On a crowbar, I'm in.
No. Well, why is it that people associate her with the Crimean War and none of our generals?
I think it's because, like you said, I figured this out. Right, the reason that she is basically
that and the charge of the Light Brigade.
Yeah, she is the heroine of this, because the charge of the Light Brigade was obviously very foolish and resulted in a cock-up of orders. Yeah. So you don't really have any heroes from the battles as such. If Earl, I've forgotten his name, Cardigan. Lord Cardigan was not really glorified.
He was
on
a hero
merits.
In military circles for his
charge. So it was like, well, who else is there? So.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think you know, every disaster needs a hero.
It needs somebody,
and,
doesn't
and
it?
So that's what happened.
And it needs
there
somebody.
There is something heroic that came out of Crimea in a military sense, though. Have you heard the phrase, the thin red line?
Yes.
Yeah, the thin red line comes from the Battle of Inkerman, which I know you're looking at that time thinking, my God, this is too long.
The battery's about to run out as well. But
we'll survive. The thin red line was a Scottish thin red line, which at the Battle of Inkerman, which was the third battle and primarily an infantry battle, the British took the brunt of a Russian a Russian attack to try and break the siege of Sevastopol, which the British and the French were trying to do at that time. And a gap in the lines opened up, and the Russians charged at it, and the Scots guards, I think it is, strung themselves out in a very thin two parallel line, which was unusual at the time, and they were instructed, chaps, this is where we die, so let's do it well. And they succeeded in repulsing the Russian charge. And Russell, the guy you were talking about, the reporter who reported all these, was watching it, and I think wrote in his report, glorious to see this thin red line saving the day. And that phrase has stuck with us.
When you say thin red line, what
because they were wearing red tunics.
I know that, but from like three men?
It was two men deep, and I think it was only about 200 or 300 long. I do have the figure somewhere, but
it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, but so the thin red line came out of the Crimea as well.
Well, that's worth having a Crimea for.
Well, I feel you stretch the point.
Probably not, yeah. We're going to have to take a quick break. But we'll be back in a second after I've been to the toilet and changed the battery. So, Steve, tell us about the last feature. The Tooth Factory.
I don't have anything to tell you about that other than what was said in the video, bar one thing. I just want to clarify that factory doesn't itself make false teeth anymore. That what was that factory, the company has been incorporated into other companies, and that company still makes the majority of false teeth, certainly in America and I think in this country as well.
Yeah, because the company now in Kentish Town is some
it's not there anymore.
Charity and something.
There's
else,
loads. Yeah, there's even a film studio in there.
Yeah.
That has now been incorporated over the years into a company that still makes false teeth.
Well, I'll give you an interesting.
That's what I meant.
Interesting fact about Claudius Ash's factory there. By 1915, the company was a worldwide presence within 24 cities, and it's solely unmarried female staff.
I beg your pardon?
Those were the
unmarried female staff made the teeth?
Yeah.
That's a bit odd.
It is, but I guess because everyone else was at the war.
Yeah. Fighting. I don't want to talk about the false teeth factory anyway.
What did you want to talk about?
Well, we didn't finish the war, as in, when did it finish?
Okay, go on.
you don't want to talk about that, do you?
Well, I'm just curious because we don't want to bore people, but go on. If you think you've got something to tell, please do. Oh,
right, okay, so I'm boring people now.
No.
Okay, right, well, the war finished, it started 1854, well, 1853, but Britain was involved in 1854. Alma is 1854, Balaclava is October 1854, Inkerman's November, and then the Russians don't attack anymore. And the siege of Sevastopol goes on until 1856. Sevastopol falls, there's the Paris Peace Conference, everybody goes home in a kind of honourable draw. Nobody really gets what they want.
Honourable draw.
And then I'm done.
Good.
Yeah, I mean, apart really... from one thing.
Go on.
I forgot to tell you about Lord Raglan.
You've got to be quick because
I'll be really quick. Because Lord Raglan, remember, he fought under Wellington?
Yeah.
Our allies at Crimea are the French.
And Which Lord is Raglan, unusual.
It is, but Lord Raglan had always been used to our enemies being the French. So being so old, he used to forget frequently. So right. he used to refer to the enemy as the French, not the Russians. and this got worse because the French had a general called Can Robert, and he used to call him Can't Robert because he wouldn't advance when he asked him to. I had to tell you that.
That is good.
You've got this aging general inadvertently calling his ally the enemy.
Losing his marbles.
As well as his arm.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. Okay, Can't Robert.
You've gone back before the Claudius Ash bit. So you've got no other information about Claudius Ash, the silversmith.
I don't know. I mean, not especially. I just got really excited about the war.
Well, you should probably talk about the fact that... Obviously, these springs and the cogs, the new false teeth, because before, obviously, it was dead men's teeth from...
this idea of dead men's teeth is a bit of an exaggeration.
I don't think it is, because I've read quite a lot of information on sort of being a dentistry bonanza on the battlefield. A lot of dentists out there scouring the battlefield because the teeth were really expensive, weren't they? Human teeth.
They were. I know that they use them. I accept that they use them, but I think it's an exaggeration and a myth to say that this was enormously prevalent. Porcelain teeth soon become the order of the day. In fact, prior to that, poor people would have had wooden teeth, and I think actually getting dead men's teeth. I mean, you had to have huge amounts of wars for that, and. They still would have been fairly scarce. I just don't think this is as prevalent as it's made out.
Because most of the teeth before that are apparently made from a hippopotamus or
wood,
walrus
animal
ivory.
Bone.
But were very prone to discolouring, I believe.
Yeah, enough of the teeth. Let's wrap this up.
Dead men's teeth loaded with syphilis, just my last note there.
You can't leave me with that thought. In any case, let's finish this up. And I want everybody here to go to our Twitter... Sorry, I don't mean to point at you. You haven't done anything wrong. I want everyone to go to our Twitter, which you can find by typing in Tailhouse. I want you to go to our YouTube site, which is Tailhouse TV. If you haven't already done that, you're going to be very confused by this whole broadcast. I want you to go to our Facebook site, which you can type Tailhouse in the search bar on Facebook. And you have presumably already found us on Audio Boom or iTunes.
Arguably.
So otherwise you wouldn't be listening to this.
So that's it.
Next episode is on the most powerful and famous prisoner ever to be kept in the Tower of London, and I bet you don't know.
Because I don't either. Thank you very much for listening, and we will see you for episode 3.
Yay!
Bye.